Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
From the Missouri School of Journalism, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Raymond Tongakar, filling in for David Reed. Last week, voters in Zimbabwe took part in the country's presidential election. The contest pitted longtime President Robert Mugabe against his rival Morgan Tsvangirai. In the end, Mugabe won the election with a reported 61% of the vote. But his opponent is not conceding without putting up a fight. Tsvangirai alleges that vote rigging and widespread fraud cost him the election. Here's what he told South Africa's e-news channel, Africa.
This is an election that reflects that this is a coup by ballot. It's not the reflection of the will of the people. It becomes null and void because it has no legitimacy. It's brazen.
Today on Global Journalist, we'll take a closer look at Zimbabwe's presidential election. Joining us to talk about this, Takura Zangaza is the director of the Voluntary Media Council of Zimbabwe. That's a media advocacy organization. Also with us, Ernest Mudzengi is the director at Media Center. That's an organization that assists freelance journalists in Zimbabwe. Gentlemen, thank you both for joining me today on Global Journalist.
Thank you for inviting me.
Okay, well, I want to start out by asking, you're both calling from Harare, the capital. I want to ask what the mood is like there right now. Takura, why don't you start first?
The mood is a bit anxious, but the politics seems to have sort of like dissipated. But by and large, it's now back to business as usual.
Okay, it's back to business as usual. Ernest, could you talk about how the election results are being perceived by everyday Zimbabweans? Takura mentioned that it's an anxious mood. Are the results seen as being legitimate, or do people feel that the election was a sham?
When the results started coming in, people were largely saying that this election has been stolen. But as time went by, people started doing an analysis. For example, they started looking at what the MDC was gaining, where it was winning, and so on and so forth. So, well, what we now have is now in analysis, and part of what is emerging is that, yes, there might have been some vote rigging, but to a larger extent, especially in some areas, ZANU-PF actually won the election.
Okay, and you mentioned MDC and ZANU-PF. MDC, the Movement for Democratic Change, that was Morgan Tsvangirai's party, and ZANU-PF was Robert Mugabe's party. So listeners might recall that back in 2008, the two also faced each other in a presidential election. And in the first round, MDC, the Movement for Democratic Change, won the first round. What's happened since then, since 2008? Has the MDC lost favor among voters?
No, I wouldn't necessarily say that the MDC has lost the favor among people. But what may have also happened is an issue about organization. You know, when you are working with people, you need to constantly be in touch with the people. You also need to make sure that your membership is well organized in terms of being registered to vote and such other things. There is always a tendency among politicians to be complacent, thinking that people are still on our side. And in the meanwhile, others would also be working, because ZANU-PF itself, knowing its situation of losing popularity among the generality of Zimbabweans, started working soon after the 2008 elections. We had the ZANU-PF candidates or potential candidates starting going to scout for constituencies and doing some bit of work there.
Okay, and why was ZANU-PF so successful at mobilizing voters? Dakota, do you want to take that? Did they have an advantage over the MDC?
Yeah, well, they have the initial advantage of being, of having been in power for 33 years. So they're an experienced party. So they've been campaigning since 2008, and the MDC, meanwhile, was a bit lackadaisical in its approach. It took things a bit too casually and did not prepare adequately for the election.
Okay, but correct me if I'm wrong. In 2008, there was still a lot of public anger over the eventual deal that led to an uneasy power-sharing deal between Mugabe and Tsvangirai. Was that anger still there this year, or had it subsided?
The anger had subsided because most of the anger was the result of the economic crisis that the country was faced with in 2007 and 2008. And the inclusive government stabilized the economy. And therefore, the easy anger at ZANU-PF was difficult to discern. It was more to do with which party is promising whatever the people was better.
Okay, and what issues came up in this round of elections?
I think the two parties, there are two different sort of economic models and proposals. ZANU-PF was talking about indigenization, economic empowerment, whilst the ANC was talking about reintegration of the global economy into international economy, as well as the creation of jobs, a program that they call the JUICE. And then they also talked about getting rid of Zimbabwe's pariah status. There were two distinct approaches to the economy from the two parties.
Okay, and you mentioned indigenization earlier. Ernest, could you describe what that is or what that policy would entail?
Indigenization basically is about transferring ownership of resources, especially economic resources and natural resources, to the black majority. You probably remember that we had a colonial history in Zimbabwe, and that colonial leaders left most of the resources under the ownership of white people, and mainly we have had large international corporations actually owning things here. We have people from companies from the United Kingdom and other countries, being the ones that are mainly involved in the extractive industry. So the indigenization is basically about making sure that the black people or the so-called indigenous Zimbabweans are in a position to control the means of production. They are in a position to be in key economic positions.
Okay, so it's a policy then of redistributing ownership of natural resources and companies to local ownership. Is there a parallel between what happened in Zimbabwe in the early 2000s, where a lot of land was redistributed to local owners as well?
In 2000, the mood was quite different. Obviously, people were disenchanted with ZANU-PF. They were fed up, actually. They thought that ZANU-PF had run them down. You know, the economy had gone down, and, all sorts of things were happening. We had violence, and this time around, we didn't have much violence. And we also didn't have an inclusive government in 2000. This time, we had an inclusive government, and some people were also saying that the MDC should have done something during this era, the inclusive government. So it's a different context altogether, because we had no inclusive government in 2000. We had violence then, but in 2013 there was no violence to talk about.
You earlier mentioned that there was this belief that the MDC didn't do enough while they were in this inclusive government from 2008 to present day. Why do you think that was the case? Why didn't they do more? And I guess, is that a fair accusation, that they just didn't do enough while they were in power?
Well, yeah, obviously, there are some people who have accused them. You know, the MDC, for example, controlled and still is going to control local councils in the urban areas. But they didn't do much. For example, there were no works programs, even simple ones. They could do. For example, they've taken even their youth and they made sure that they could do things like filling potholes, things like cutting grass, and so on and so forth. Those things were not being done. And some would say that no, ZANU-PF was blocking them, but they could have at least done simple things like making sure that You clear the garbage, making sure that the potholes are cleared. You know, you just design a works program where you can use unemployed youth.
Okay. Takoda, what will the MDC need to do in the future, moving on to, I guess, to remain relevant and also to possibly win the next presidential election? Have you heard from any MDC officials or in terms of what they're planning?
Well, they've officially so far announced that they were thinking about not participating in parliament. But now there's a news story today that says, yes, they will probably go to parliament and that they will also be in local government. But they're not yet sure what they will do over and about the actual electoral results except going to court. That's what is being waited for. But in order for them to win the next election in 5 years, well, they have to go back to their membership and have to go back to their original mobilization strategy to get their members to understand what went wrong, as well as to literally restructure and reconstruct the components of their party at popular level.
You just mentioned the court challenge that would contest the election results. Do you think that's likely to? Do you think that challenge is likely to make it to court?
It will go to court, yes. It will be heard before the Constitutional Court, in line with our Constitution. And, after that, we don't know what the judges decide. I know that there have been comments about the judges being appointed by the president and therefore they're biased. But I think the MDC has also had some favorable judgments for its own issues in the last year or two.
Okay. Well, I want to talk about Robert Mugabe's age. Was that an issue that came up in this election? At 89, was there a concern that he might not be able to fulfill the five-year presidential term that he just won?
Yeah, mainly from the MDC. They used it as a campaign tool. So, let's say, okay, vote for an 89-year-old. From a Zanu-PF perspective, it wasn't really about his age. It was about their party, and they intended to win collectively. They had more of a collective approach to it. But by and large, it was really never a generational question when it came to the election or an age question. It was literally binary. It was which party will you vote for, never mind the leader. And this was the key thing here, or never mind the age of a leader. It was literally a political party campaign. Indeed, personalities played a key role in some of the campaign, but when push came to shove, it was literally about which party would an individual vote for.
So with the two parties that we're talking about, ZANU-PF and MDC, is there a difference in terms of the type of people that that are affiliated with either party? Yeah, like, for example, is there a difference between like rural and urban areas, young and old?
Yeah, there's a difference.
One point, the perception was that ZANU-PF is a stronghold in rural areas, but when we look at the results that we have now, for this past election, I think the MDC has made some inroads into other urban centers, especially the smaller ones. ZANU-PF has made inroads, for example, in areas like Kwekwe, areas like Kadoma. Those are smaller cities, while MDC has remained largely in the bigger cities of Bulawayo and Harare. They actually got almost all the seats in Bulawayo, and here in Harare, they lost some 4 seats or something. But what it means is that ZANU-PF, as per the most recent elections, has now made inroads into the urban areas, which at one point were perceived to be MDC strongholds. And at the same time, you will discover that in 2008, the MDC made some inroads into some rural constituencies, including those in Mashingo and Manicaland. But that was, we reversed radically on July 31. For example, in Manicaland, where MDC used to have 25 seats or so, then they were left with 4. And in Mashingo, they got nothing, and yet they had, in the 2008 election, gotten at least 5 seats or something.
Okay. Well, I want to move on and talk about the role the media played in this presidential election. But before we continue our discussion, I want to remind our listeners that you could view or listen to this program anytime by downloading our podcasts at globaljournalist.org. There you'll also find articles, photos, and interviews related to our program. Also, please send us questions or comments via globaljournalist@kbia.org or on our Facebook page. You could also follow us on Twitter at @GlobalJourn. Now, right now, we'll hear from Itai Mushekwe. He's a Zimbabwean journalist that's been living in Germany since 2007. It was then that he discovered his name on a government blacklist of unwanted political reporters. He spoke to global journalist producer Nin Pham earlier this week about media freedom in Zimbabwe. Here's what he had to say.
It was really terrible when I left, and even now it's not getting any better. But the government has many terrible laws which restrict journalists from practicing freely. Private media is there, but it is like an elite private media. You know what I'm trying to say? It is very, very small, and it is only in the capital city. And there are not so many people who access this sort of media because, for instance, in Zimbabwe, a newspaper costs, I think, about $1 or $1.50. And it makes no sense for someone to spend almost $2 on a newspaper when they can buy 2 loaves of bread, you know? It's not everybody who's that rich. So the private media is very small in Zimbabwe, and it's not effective at all.
Dakour, do you agree with what Itai said, just his description of the media landscape? And he also said that private media options were limited and largely only available in large cities.
Well, I think as regards the operational space of the private media, he's correct. The environment remains repressive. There's the criminalization of journalism and freedom of expression. There's also the continued targeting of not only media personnel and professionals, but also ordinary citizens who express opinions that differ with the mainstream, both in terms of the law and in terms of the political culture. He is also correct to mention that the private media is largely available, the private print media is largely available in urban areas, but it's now significantly available in most urban areas. Then there are two private radio stations, which though are somewhat linked to people that are members of ZANU-PF or the government, are now more and more nationally available on frequency modulation or FM. But by and large, the major challenge has been the legal criminalization of the media and the repressive approach of the government towards journalists and the private media houses.
Okay. Well, you mentioned a number of challenges that journalists face. Let's unpack that, though. You mentioned the criminalization of journalists in Zimbabwe. What laws are in place that lead this to happen?
Well, there are a lot of laws that are in place, but they're all interlinked. But the major ones include the Access to Information and Protection of Privacy Act, which requires that all journalists register with the Zimbabwe Media Commission. And they pay a fee to register, and they cannot practice without the accreditation or the registration certificate. And should they practice without that, they're liable to a fine or a jail sentence. And this is the same for media houses. So if you want to start a newspaper, you have to register with that media commission, and you can't do anything without it. And at the same time, they have the authority to then say you've published something wrong, and therefore you can be subject to criminal proceedings. And there are other laws, such as the Public Order and Security Act, which then also impinge on the work of journalists if they undermine state security, the government, or the president's authority, and so on. So there are a lot of, and these are just two. There are many others that relate to defense, that relate to national security. But these are the laws that affect the function of the journalists, and therefore there's no free media in Zimbabwe.
You mentioned that journalists have to be accredited from a government organization. Are certain media outlets targeted? For example, if you're a journalist working with a newspaper that's not sympathetic to the government or ZANU-PF, would it be less likely that you would become accredited?
If everybody has to be accredited. I think the whole issue is that even the private media gets accredited. But it's what happens after accreditation. Some people perhaps might not be subject to as much scrutiny as the private media journalists and the private media house owners. So, if, for example, most of the state media journalists might not be as vulnerable as the private media journalists. And this is why the selective application of an already undemocratic law.
Are there notable instances in which journalists have been prosecuted under, earlier you mentioned a state secrecy bill, where journalists have been targeted for releasing what was maybe designated classified information?
Yes, on a number of occasions, journalists have been asked to come to the police or been detained overnight over what has been alleged leaking of cabinet minutes or leaking of cabinet proceedings. And also, in some instances, journalists have been arrested for undermining the authority of the police, the authority of the defense forces. And these cases go as far back as the 90s, where editors were once arrested for alleging that there was a coup plot in Zimbabwe. So you definitely have a number of cases that relate to journalists being directly targeted by the state for what they report and what they write.
And so what effect has this had on journalists in Zimbabwe? Are more journalists self-censoring if they're covering, you know, if they're like political reporters, for example?
Yeah, you have to be careful about what you write. Even if you have a scoop or a very good story which is based on facts and evidence, yeah, you have to be careful that you don't get arrested for the story. And the risk is that you then have to be cautious about your investigative journalism. You have to be cautious about even the media owner now has to be cautious about what to publish, because the state may decide that this one is enough to either seek to institute proceedings for the closure of a paper, or alternatively to just close it and wait for any other court proceedings that happen. So it does lead to self-censorship, both on the part of the journalist as well as on the part of the media house owner or the radio station owner or the newspaper owner.
Okay, and this is for both of you. I do recall an instance where either you or a colleague was directly affected by this criminalization of journalists.
Yeah, definitely. The criminalization of journalists, the laws criminalizing journalists affect us in a number of ways. Because you will discover that when you talk of the Public Order and Security Act, for example, it affects the freedom of assembly. And it also affects journalists in some way, in terms of publishing falsehoods or whatnot. That may cause alarm and despondence. Then you also have laws such as the Criminal Codification and Law Reform Act, which also have to do with the issues such as causing alarm and despondence. You also have the laws such as the Criminal Evidence and Procedure Act, which can result in people being detained, notwithstanding the fact that they have been granted bail, and many journalists have had that being invoked against them. Then the same applies to civic activists like ourselves. We have also been exposed to such laws that criminalize freedom, be it freedom of expression, freedom of assembly, and others. Yeah.
Okay, and Ernest, you work with freelancers. Are there specific challenges that they face that other journalists working for newspapers or broadcasters wouldn't?
Yes, definitely. In fact, the fact of our existence testifies to the challenges, the many challenges that are faced by freelance journalists. As a matter of fact, they are not attached to a particular organization, and they have to make sure that they have to write and earn anything. They are not guaranteed of a salary at the end of the month. That's number one. Then number two, they don't have readily available equipment, especially those who are outside Harare, where there are no media centers like the one we have here. They don't have equipment. Then three, they don't have people who can help them in terms of legal representation in case of being sued and so on and so forth. You know, there are a lot of insult laws in this country, and if you are deemed to have violated it, you may be sued by wealthy people, we include politicians, and you may not have, money to defend yourself, to hire a lawyer, and so on and so forth. And the other challenges also include the fact that they may have to work from insecure areas, especially for the other centers where we don't have facilities like those that we have here. And they are also not guaranteed of an income on a monthly basis. You know, they have to pay for rentals, and so on and so forth. But you may write and you may not be able to sell stories, or some newspapers may decide not to pay you.
Okay. Well, we only have about 1 minute left, so I'll have to ask you to keep your responses brief. But are there any campaigns that you're working on to protect the rights of journalists in Zimbabwe? Tokura, why don't you start first?
There are some campaigns right now. For example, the Voluntary Media Council is campaigning for self-regulation of the media, and we implement media self-regulation with the support of most of the media. And some resistance in part from the state-controlled media. But that's the major campaign we have from our side. And then there's MISA, the Media Institute of Southern Africa, has a broadcasting campaign to liberalize the airwaves, as well as an access to information campaign.
Okay, and Ernest, is there a campaign that you want to talk about as well?
Yeah, basically, those are the main campaigns. They are mainly being conducted by MISA Zimbabwe, which is pushing for legal reforms and so on and so forth. So from our side, we basically work with the practical side of things, providing journalists space and so on and so forth. But the issues of freedom, advocates for that, is mainly done by MISA Zimbabwe. And the campaigns that he has mentioned are mainly those that are taking place where they have engaged in particular campaigns at a particular time, yeah.
And we'll have to leave it at that. We've come to the end of this week's edition of Global Journalist, produced by the Reynolds Journalism Institute and the Missouri School of Journalism. Joining us today were Tokura Zangaza of the Voluntary Media Council of Zimbabwe and Ernest Mudzenge of the Media Center. Global Journalist is directed by Travis McMillan, audio by Pat Akers. Today's episode was produced by Nin Pham, Sasu Siegelbaum, and Casey Morell. Stay tuned for Free Press Watch, and please join us again next week for another Global Journalist. I'm Raymond Tongakar, filling in for David Reed.
And now, Free Press Watch, Global Journalist's weekly rundown of the major events affecting press freedom around the world. I'm Casey Morell. Today's news comes from the Committee to Protect Journalists. New Zealand's government is being criticized for obtaining the phone records of a journalist who wrote a story about a classified government document that leaked. Andrea Vance obtained a copy of the Kitteridge Report, which alleges the country's intelligence services illegally gathered data on more than 80 people in the country. The government then admitted that 3 months' worth of data on Vance's phone calls were collected and turned over to a parliamentary commission investigating the leak of the report. Vance's visits to parliament were also tracked and turned over to the same committee. Prime Minister John Key alleges nobody looked at the phone logs that were collected, but Vance disputes those claims. South Africa's state broadcaster SABC has refused to air a documentary detailing the alleged theft of public money during the country's apartheid era. Broken Spear was originally set to air last November as part of a series on South African history, but was shelved. When Sheila Vollenhoven, the filmmaker behind the documentary, began to show Broken Spear at film festivals, SABC filed a lawsuit stating that public screenings violate the company's copyright on the film and demanding that she turn over all raw tape and materials associated with the film. Vollenhoven offered to buy the film rights back from SABC, but the broadcaster refused. For more on these and other stories involving press freedom around the world, please visit our website at globaljournalist.org. Thank you for joining us this week on Global Journalist. I'm Casey Morell.